It's Essential Pittsburgh. I'm Paul Guggenheimer. It's crunch time at the state capitol, as in numbers crunching. Today is the deadline for passing a state budget. The Republican-controlled House passed their plan over the weekend, and the GOP-dominated Senate is expected to approve it with perhaps some modifications and send it off to the governor today. But Governor Wolf, a Democrat, is expected to veto the budget, along with pension and liquor privatization proposals he does not support. So the budget deadline set for midnight tonight will almost surely be missed, and there is the potential for some level of financial turmoil in the Keystone State as a result. But before we get ahead of ourselves, I'm joined now by phone from Harrisburg by House Majority Leader Dave Reed, representing the 62nd Legislative District in Indiana County. Representative Reed, thanks for joining us.
Paul, thanks for having me on the show.
If you have a comment or question for House Majority Leader Dave Reed, you can call us at 412-246-2002. That's 412-246-2002. Email ESSPGH@WESA.FM and on Twitter at ESSPGH. Representative Reed, Democrats have criticized the House budget as having only Republican input. Why were the Democrats in the legislature left out of this process?
Well, I actually think that's a little bit of a disingenuous comment by the House Democrats. They've been in every single budget meeting we've had with the Senate and with the governor as well. And I understand that they do want to go a different direction as far as the final budget proposal goes. They support the $5 billion in new spending the governor put on the table in March, and the $12 billion in new tax increases the governor put on the table in March as well over the next 2 years. And it's just not a situation where there's complete agreement on how to move forward. In the House and the Senate, we obviously have the majorities, and we have taken our responsibility to meet our June 30th deadline very, very seriously. So we put together a budget proposal that had majority support in the House and the Senate on increasing funding for education, balancing the budget, doing so without any new taxes going forward. And we will send it to the governor later on today.
Is this the Republican legislature's way of putting a first-year Democratic governor with an ambitious agenda that many of you do not agree with, calling for major changes in state tax policy and increased funding for education, of putting him in his place? And I put this question to Senator Jay Costa yesterday, and he said he thinks it's part of that. It's at least part of the reason for this impasse. What is your feeling about it, Representative Reed?
No, I think ideally we would have liked to have gotten to a five-party agreement with the governor, our colleagues across the aisle in the House and in the Senate. We take the June 30th deadline very seriously. We don't have a complete agreement, so we felt that there's no need to disrupt the operation of government while we continue to negotiate on other items that the governor may feel need to be part of any final budget solution that could come in the weeks or months ahead. The House passed property tax reform about a month ago, so we are very serious about property tax reform in the House, and we understand that the Senate isn't quite there yet on that big issue. And more than anything else, we just don't think we need to hold up state government. We don't need to hold schools or human service programs hostage while we continue to negotiate some of these other items that, you know, quite frankly, they're important to the governor, but they're important to a lot of our members as well.
I understand that House members met with the governor this morning. Did anything productive come out of that?
No, it was a fairly brief discussion where we basically just talked about, you know, the fact that the bills are going to be coming over to the governor later today on liquor privatization, pension reform, and the budget. And the governor had said that he's going to obviously make some decisions on what he's going to do with those proposals. He didn't tell us exactly what those decisions would be. But after those decisions are made, he hoped to talk to us about additional priorities as soon as possible. And I think that's something that we are very interested in as well.
One of the priorities for the governor, and I would imagine for you as well, is education and the funding of education of public schools in the state of Pennsylvania. Critics among the Democrats are looking at the figure that House Republicans gave of $100 million being put into the basic education line as disingenuous, because they say that $92 million in funding is being removed so that the net increase to school districts is actually $8 million. Because of the way those figures are the plus and minuses when you factor everything in. So what about that accusation from the Democrats that your figures, as far as funding education, are misleading?
I think it's completely false. It is $100 million new dollars in education, plus additional monies for early childhood education and higher education. The only numbers they cite as justification for their fuzzy math is the fact that we are now going to pay, and we reimburse the school districts for their Social Security payments. We're going to pay when that bill comes due, as opposed to prepaying before they even get the bills from the federal government. And then there were minor adjustments to the pension payments as well to reflect the fact that there are less pension payments needed this particular year than there was in March. You know, every month that goes by, the pension calculation changes just a little bit. You know, you've got new employees coming into the system, old employees going out of the system. So we just use the most updated numbers that were provided by the retirement systems to reflect that. The $100 million is new money going into school districts to provide for teachers, books, textbooks, technology, and everything else.
Going back to the pension plan, with regard to the proposed changes to state pension benefits in the proposed budget, critics of the Republicans say that the plan has no immediate impact on the pension deficit problem. What about that?
Well, I think we view pension reform not as a way of just not paying our bills and spending more money today. That, quite frankly, is how we got into this mess under Governor Rendell, and even Governor Corbett had taken a look at a similar approach under his administration. We view public pension reform as getting us off of this roller coaster ride for our retirees, our current employees, our future employees, and our taxpayers. We need to bring predictability to the system. We view pension reform as a way of making sure, and the bill does this, current retirees are not going to be impacted at all. Current employees are going to be able to keep the same exact structure of a plan that they have today. New employees are going to go into a hybrid system where you got a defined benefit and a defined contribution component to your retirement. And to lead by example, we're going to require current legislators to go into that new plan as well. If it's good enough for new employees, it should be good enough for legislators as well. It's time for once legislators led from the front.
Current legislators.
Current legislators will be transitioned to the new plan.
The pension plan being proposed, from what we understand, it would work like a 401k for employees like future school teachers, for example. But it allows future public safety workers such as state troopers and corrections officers to be enrolled in the existing defined benefit plans. Can you explain why it's being set up this way? Why these officers and no one else?
There is a unique set of circumstances when you're looking at those officers, particularly with the state police, where they are not eligible for Social Security from the federal government. So in recognizing that difference in those classifications, we kept the current system for those employees. And for all new employees in all other sectors, it's actually going to be a 401k style system plus a defined benefit style system combined. It just won't be as generous of a benefit on the defined benefit side as it is currently. So it'll be a hybrid of the two systems.
It's Essential Pittsburgh. I'm Paul Guggenheimer, and my guest with us by phone from Harrisburg, House Majority Leader Dave Reed. If you have a comment or question for him, 412-246-2002 is the number to call. Again, tonight is the deadline at midnight tonight for the budget to be passed and signed by the governor. It doesn't look like that's going to happen, but we'll see, and we'll keep the governor on this very busy day on the floor of the legislature in the state capitol. We'll try to keep him on the line for as long as we can with the many questions that we have, as well as yours. And Representative Reed, the governor is holding the Democratic line against liquor privatization. Republicans like yourself say privatization is long overdue. Why is it important for the legislators like yourself, for the GOP, to get this done this year?
Well, I think it's one of those things that has been talked about for about 80 years when we ended prohibition and put into place a liquor system in Pennsylvania that sole goal was basically to keep folks from accessing, you know, wine and spirits. We look at liquor privatization from a couple different perspectives. You know, number one, we certainly question whether we need to be the only other state other than Utah that has a complete monopoly over the liquor business. Why can't we be like the other 48 states that has allowed the private sector to enter into that realm? Number two, we want to maximize recurring revenue coming into the Commonwealth. The proposal that we are going to move through the House and the Senate today will add $200 million on top of existing revenues year after year to the state budget. That's money that can be used for education, transportation, other items of importance to the citizens of Pennsylvania. Number three, particularly being from Western Pennsylvania, we've got folks who generally travel to Maryland, Virginia, the Carolinas. You know, they like the convenience of being able to go to a grocery store and buy a bottle of wine. They wonder, can't we have that same sort of convenience here in Pennsylvania as well?
And I think a lot of people understand the Republican position on this. One concern might be is that, you know, the state has been in the liquor business for better or worse for lo these many years, and it pulls in a lot of money as a result of that. Are you saying that a privatization plan could work out better financially for the state?
Well, I think that's an absolute key. I, for one, do not want to see us go backwards. I don't think any liquor proposal should be a revenue loser for the Commonwealth. And that's why we structured it in a way with our colleagues in the Senate, where not only will we keep the existing revenue we have today, but because of the way that we're maximizing the use of the system going forward, we're going to add $200 million on an annual basis on top of those revenues.
Let's talk about Governor Wolf's push for a tax on drilling. Isn't this one way to fund education in other important areas? Why are Republicans like yourself so steadfastly opposed to this?
You know, I think probably the biggest frustration on the Governor Severance tax proposal is it's really just an outlandish proposal that they put together to try to just meet a budget number to make their budget balance. His proposal would have an effective tax rate of almost 20%. It would be the highest tax in the nation. You know, I think it's incumbent to have a real discussion on the proper methodology of taxing the natural gas industry, but we've got to do so in a responsible manner that doesn't, you know, put us as an outlier on how other states are treating this particular industry. And I'll just give you an example. He's got a price floor in his proposal that says, you know, no matter what price the companies are getting for the natural gas they're selling, they're going to pay as if they're getting $2.97 an MCF. Right now, most of the companies out west are getting $1.25, $1.30. That's like saying to a family, hey, we understand that you're only making $35,000 a year, but we're going to tax you as if you're making $100,000 a year. You know, the taxes should be based upon profits, not just the pays upon some artificial number.
If what Governor Wolf is currently proposing, if it's too steep, in your opinion, what is the middle ground here? Is there a middle ground as far as you're concerned?
Well, I think the first thing we need to do is have an accurate reflection. Okay, what taxes are the industry paying right now in Pennsylvania? We've got the highest corporate net income tax in Pennsylvania, in the nation as well, here in Pennsylvania. And then we've got the impact fee. And I've talked to my colleagues, Republican and Democrat, who believe that we should keep the impact fee in place because those are dollars that are going back to the local communities actually impacted by the industry and being used for environmental programs to make sure we're safeguarding our natural resources going forward. I think that's got to be the basis of the starting point. Look, and if there are adjustments that could be made through those discussions on that tax structure, so be it. But I don't think we want to start as being the highest tax in the nation.
Representative Reed, can you give us a glimpse into the way that the negotiations work, the give and take of talks between leaders in the legislature like yourself and the governor? Do you, for example, say, okay, you know, we know that that you really want to have some kind of severance tax on Marcellus shale drilling? We'll give you that if you give us, you know, some sort of outline for liquor privatization, you know, kind of that sort of trade-off. Is that how the negotiations work, or is it done differently?
Well, I think it's probably fair to characterize the negotiations on some of the big issues that have been out there. On public pension reform, I actually think we've had very fruitful negotiations with the administration and our colleagues in the Senate, and actually the bill that we are passing through the House as we speak actually reflects in the ballpark of a compromise that was talked about with the administration. So I think those talks were very fruitful and very productive over the last several months. I don't think we had the same level of productivity with discussions on liquor privatization or taxation, nor did we have the same sort of discussion on the budget in general. Obviously, you know, as Republicans, you know, we looked at last year's budget as a starting point. The governor put out his budget as his starting point in March. We're obviously willing to compromise in that respect, adding $200 million to education as part of the budget we're moving forward today. You know, part of the problem has been, quite frankly, the governor still has stuck to every single tax increase and every single piece of spending that he put on the table in March. And that's just not realistic. That's not compromise. That's not movement. Particularly, you know, when the governor presented his budget in March, he was projecting a $2.3 billion structural deficit. That deficit's now down to less than $1 billion. At least some of those taxes should be able to come off the table when you got $1 billion extra in revenue because of the way they've come in over the last several months.
Is it a matter of changing a mindset? I mean, Democrats, you know, traditionally, one of the reasons why they're opposed to privatization of liquor sales, even though so many in the state want it and it would seem to make common sense, is that, you know, there's the traditional Democratic idea of protecting the jobs of these union employees, and as well as on issues like pension reform. That there are these legacy benefits that people are used to expecting that the state may not be able to afford anymore. So is part of your approach to dealing with this to maybe change the mindset of some of these, of a governor who definitely subscribes to some of these traditional Democratic Party values?
Well, I think part of the discussion, and I'll just use pension reform as an example. Look, our goal in pension reform is not that different from the governor's. We want to make sure retirees get their checks in the mail. We want to make sure current employees are keeping the same structure of a plan that they signed up for. And going forward, we just want to create a new plan for new employees, including legislators, that is reasonable for the employee, but also reasonable for the taxpayer paying the bill. And given the unfunded liabilities in the system that have accrued over the last couple of decades, you know, the pension system's $50 billion in debt. If we just keep letting it going as we are today, we're going to end up in a situation like Detroit, where you can actually see the pension system go bankrupt here in Pennsylvania, and then you're going to have retirees and current employees getting pennies on the dollars for the pensions they've been paying into for decades. And I don't think that's a situation anybody really wants in the end.
We've been talking with Representative Dave Reed. He's the House Majority Leader and represents the 62nd Legislative District in Indiana County. We know it's a very busy day in the legislature. You've been very generous with your time, Representative Reed. Thank you so much for taking the time to join us here today on Essential Pittsburgh.
Oh, thank you very much for having me.
All right, good luck.
Thank you.
One note we'd like to make regarding something that was mentioned on yesterday's show. We were talking to John Misek, a editorial page editor for opinions editor for the Harrisburg Patriot News and Penn Live regarding the state budget. And a listener emailed us, Jim, pointed out that John Misek made a comment that the state parks may need to close as a result of the budget not meeting the deadline. And he referenced Falling Water as a possible closure. Jim points out that Falling Water is owned and operated by the Western Pennsylvania Conservancy, a public nonprofit corporation, and says goes on to say, Falling Water is not and never has been owned by the state. So, Jim, we appreciate your getting in contact with us and making that correction for us. Coming up, we'll preview the big Women's World Cup semifinal tonight between the U.S. and Germany and gauge the popularity of soccer in the Berg. It's Essential Pittsburgh on 90.5 WESA. It's Essential Pittsburgh. I'm Paul Guggenheimer. It's been 16 years since the United States last won the Women's World Cup of Soccer. But the American team can take a mighty step towards that goal tonight with a win over Germany in the semifinals being played in Montreal. And the U.S. team will be counting on a Pittsburgh area native, Pine Richland graduate, Megan Klingenberg to help that effort in her role as a defender for the U.S. team. Joining us to talk about the rise in prominence of soccer in general and women's soccer in particular here in Pittsburgh is Pittsburgh Post-Gazette sports writer Megan Ryan, who writes about the Pittsburgh Riverhounds soccer team, among other things. She joins us in studio. Megan Ryan, welcome to Essential Pittsburgh.
Hello. Thanks for having me.
And also with us by phone to provide a historical perspective on Pittsburgh soccer is our regular sports guy, Post-Gazette sports writer emeritus, Bob Dvorak. Hi, Bob.
Hey, Paul. Great to be here. Can you feel the excitement building?
I can. And it comes in fits and starts when it comes to soccer, and we'll kind of get into that aspect of it. But let's begin by looking at tonight's Women's World Cup game between the U.S. and Germany. The Germans are ranked number one. The Americans are number two. Has any soccer game involving a U.S. women's team been as eagerly anticipated as this one is, Megan?
Well, I think so. I mean, there's been a lot of great games in the history of the U.S. women's national team. I mean, just going back to the most iconic ones, the 1999 final with that Brandi Chastain penalty kick taking the shirt off. I mean, that was pretty eagerly anticipated. And then the last World Cup, 2011, when they were in the final against Japan, that was a pretty big deal. I remember that was really when the hype around women's soccer, I kind of felt, reached its pinnacle. Everyone was watching that game. Unfortunately, they didn't win, and then it kind of petered off after that. But, I mean, this one is definitely, it's ramping up again. And Germany, with it being the number one ranked team against the number two ranked team in the U.S., it's going to be a really good game. I think probably the best game in the World Cup so far. So it'll be good to watch.
Yeah, and the U.S., they beat China back in 1999, and and I guess a lot of us who maybe don't follow the sport as closely as we should have always kind of envisioned, you know, U.S. number one, maybe China a close second or on a par with the United States, and that the win by Japan was more of an aberration. And but the U.S. is really the team, you know, usually the team to beat, like in hockey. But apparently that's not the case. There are some other nations, including Germany, who are pretty darn good. And there's a good chance the U.S. could get beaten tonight.
Yeah, that's definitely true. The U.S. for a long time has been a powerhouse in women's soccer, mostly because it's got that, you know, collegiate system that other countries don't have.
Title IX and all those.
All that stuff. So, like, women's soccer, girls' soccer at the youth level is a huge sport among young girls, and then they all go on and play in college. And when you're looking at European countries, they're really into the academy system, which is a professional. This is getting really deep, sorry.
That's okay. But that's why you're here.
The academy system, which is, it's for the men's teams at least, it's like these young boys will go into, like, FC Barcelona, the youth teams, and they'll like be in the under 10 team, under 12 team, under 14 team, all the way until they work their way up into the senior side, which is the best team. And they won't really like go to school. That'll be like what they do is play soccer. So women's soccer is not
that
exactly,
sounds like a good, yeah, I think I would have liked that.
It's how you get the best athletes, let me tell you. But women's soccer isn't really like that over in Europe, but now it's the other countries are kind of catching up to what the U.S. has done with the collegiate system and having, you know, more of a women's league over in Europe and trying to have a women's league in the U.S. at least. So, yeah, it's definitely let it leveled out a lot more. And I think Germany definitely is a better team than the U.S. Not to say that the U.S. can't win, but right now they are definitely number one in the world.
So, Bob, are you following all this?
Oh, absolutely. Hey, you got two teams are going to go at it today, number one and number two, with world-class goalies. Both have strong defenses and attack-minded philosophies, but there won't be many goals scored in this, I don't think. And it's one of the, you know, the knocks against the game. It's the beautiful game with the grand strategy, but there's 18 seconds of action packed into 90 minutes.
Well, some might disagree with you that scoring doesn't necessarily mean action. You know, soccer's traditionally been a low-scoring game, but there are those who think that, you know, the goalies are pretty amazing. The U.S. has Hope Solo, who's allowed just one goal in the tournament so far. And I don't even know who the German goalie is. What can you tell us? What is her name?
Nadine Angerer, I believe is how you pronounce it. She's
and
great,
she was goalie of the year, right, Megan?
Yeah, she's been FIFA World Player of the Year, the first goalkeeper to ever win that. And she is going to retire, I believe, like after this season. So it's kind of, this is like her last time. She's like in her 30s, and she's been the captain of Germany for a long time. And she's really kind of looked up to on that team, and she's a great goalkeeper. I think she has like the most, like the record for the most minutes in the World Cup played. So she's really good. So is Hope Solo, though. So I think it's really going to be a battle of those goalkeepers.
Okay, and when you're talking about defense, the woman from Pittsburgh, the Pine Richland graduate, Megan Klingenberg, is mm-hmm. a defender.
She is.
Tell us about her. What makes her such a good soccer player, and tell us about the system that here in Pittsburgh that produced her.
Yeah, definitely. Well, Megan Klingenberg she's a great defender, which you can obviously see. I mean, she's a short girl. She's only like 5'2 or something, which is not exactly, you would think of a defender to be a little bit bulkier, but she's kind of a petite girl, but she does really good defending, which was kind of evidenced in the group stage when they played Sweden to a 0-0 draw. There was a time on a set piece where one of the Swedish players got a free kick like right to the goal, and Hope Solo had to come out to try to get it, had missed it. And so the goal was wide open, but Klingenberg like kind of came back to cover the goal, and she did this header that ended up like bumping off the crossbar and out. But if she hadn't been there, it would have been a goal. So she definitely has made those key plays that have been, you know, kind of stunning and really good defense. But she also has the capability to attack, which she can kind of come out on one of those wings and go into the attacking. And that just kind of depends on what the U.S. is going to do, what kind of system they're going to run. Because they've been a little bit more defensive in the group stages, but against China, they were a little bit more attacking. So it kind of depends. But yeah, I mean, Pittsburgh, I mean, she played at Pine Richland and I'm sure did a bunch of club things, youth teams here, went on to play at UNC.
And she does clinics and things here?
Yeah, she's done a few clinics with the Riverhounds, and I think her next one she's doing in Cranberry Township July 17th through 19th for young girls. So she'll be teaching and doing all that stuff. And I'm sure she'll do some more things when the U.S. women's team comes here to play at Heinz Field. So,
if you'd like to join our conversation with Megan Ryan, who writes for the Pittsburgh Post-Gazette, and also Pittsburgh Post-Gazette sports writer emeritus Bob Dvorak, call us at 412-246-2002. We'd like to hear your soccer stories. Is Pittsburgh a soccer town, in your opinion? Do you go to watch the Riverhounds? Would you support an MLS team in Pittsburgh? And what are your feelings about women's soccer? The game certainly seems to be on the rise. 412-246-2002 is the number to call. 412-246-2002. Email is ESSPGH@WESA.FM. On Twitter at ESSPGH. Bob, you've been writing about sports for some time here in the Steel City. And, you know, there are so many, European immigrants and people from all over the world, which is a game that's played all over the world, years ago and now. What have you observed about the evolution of the game in Pittsburgh? Maybe not so much who's watching it, but who's playing it?
Well, full disclosure, Paul, both of my daughters played soccer in youth leagues in Penn Hills. And my granddaughters are playing now. The youngest one's 5. This is her second year, and that's at Hampton. There are youth programs. These high schools have done a really good job, and they set up the youth programs, you know, to get kids involved, number one, and two, maybe identify some talent. I played the game myself when the Spirit was in town. We would play indoor soccer, and they had a media team, and we played, so I got involved that way.
What position did you play, Bob?
A striker. Absolute striker.
I figured you for a striker.
I was a killer up close off the rebounds, off the boards. But be that as it may.
Right, well, the ball never goes out of play in the indoor game.
Correct. Now, but it's, you know, soccer in Pittsburgh goes back to the late 19th century. You're right, there was the European influence, and that was their game. However, Pittsburgh being an immigrant town, the way to become an American was to follow baseball. So, there was a cultural break, I think, a little bit. But, I think soccer's always been fun to play. And the question is, will people pay to watch it? And I say, well, I think they got to do better marketing, and I got to do things like, have a tailgate party, make it fun.
Well, you mentioned the Pittsburgh Spirit. They played indoors at the old Civic Arena. At a time when the Penguins were, coming up in the ranks, and it seemed like they were drawing pretty good crowds, but it didn't stick. Why do you suppose that was?
You got to have a winner in this town. Well, I think it's like most towns, and Megan would agree with me on this. You know, people come out to see a winner. They'll come out for the event, for the spectacle. If they're going to go consistently, they want to see a winner. And I don't think, one, the team's delivered, and two, maybe the, you know, look what you're competing against. Three professional teams, the Steelers with six Super Bowls, and that's where they'll be playing that game. I mean, they, you know, a football game in a football stadium, think of it. you know, the Pirates have been around so long, and the Penguins have a history, and they've won. So, you know, I think that's what soccer's up against in Pittsburgh.
Well, and Megan, talk about the game that's coming to Heinz Field. Last year, there was a big event here with a couple of English teams that came.
Mm-hmm.
Or wait a minute, it was one English team, Manchester City,
and then I think Milan, right, was here.
Okay,
was that it?
An Italian team, right? Yeah, that was Milan AC, I believe.
Yeah.
So you had that. It did pretty well. It didn't sell out, I don't think, but they had a respectable crowd. How do you think that when the U.S. women's team is coming to play what they call a friendly against Costa mm-hmm. Rica in August at Heinz Field, how do you think that game will draw?
I mean, I think it actually really depends on how they do in this World Cup. They set up these post-World Cup games. That's going to be their first game they're going to play once they're done with the World Cup. And they kind of set it up as a victory tour, sort of. So if you win the World Cup, then you go and kind of tour all these places and kind of have the fans that can actually come out and see this World Cup winning
team. What happens if you set up a victory tour and you don't win?
Exactly. I mean, they made it to the semifinals, so, like, that's pretty good. I think that'll still draw.
Sure.
But I think it kind of depends. I mean, I think it's going to help that there's Klingenberg, who's a native. I mean, people are going to want to see the hometown girl. And there's not, like, I don't know, a ton of things they're going to be competing with in the summer, really, so on a Sunday afternoon as well. So I think it's going to draw pretty well. I think the last time that the U.S. Women's National Team came to Pittsburgh and played at Heinz Field, it was, like, 2004. And they only had like 6,000 people, which was pretty small. But I think I'm optimistic they're gonna trash that number.
Well, we can only hope that they will. You know, one of the questions that comes to mind is in these big events that come once every 4 years, like the World Cup. Last year, we saw people getting excited about the U.S. team and the World Cup in general because, you know, we have so many. You know, this is becoming such a multicultural city. And it seemed like the fans for all the different teams that were in the World Cup are coming out in droves. Not so much this year, but people are still excited about the women's tournament. And my question is, why is it that you can see a city like Pittsburgh get so caught up in the high of an event like that, and then it just goes away, and we don't think about soccer for years? You know, what is the problem? Why doesn't that feeling have more staying power?
Yeah. I mean, that's the age-old question. I think if U.S. soccer and MLS could answer that, then they'd be doing a lot. The league would be a lot more in better shape. But I think it's just, you know, when you see the World Cup, you're seeing the best players pitted against each other. And it's kind of got that sense of, like, national pride and stuff with it as well. When the stakes aren't as high, when you're not seeing, like, all the best players on the same team, then it's, I mean, it loses a little bit of that flavor. That's just kind of how soccer is. I mean, even on the men's side, I mean, it's the same way, trying to, like, regain that kind of excitement over soccer once the World Cup is over. And I mean, I think it's the same with, like, with the Olympics. Like, if you look at swimming, like, we all really love Ryan Lochte and Michael Phelps when they're in the Olympics, but do any of us, like, follow them in the regular season? Like, no.
Unless it's Michael Phelps getting arrested for something.
Sure. Yeah, go ahead.
You know, but I'll mitigate that by wishing him a happy 30th birthday today. He turns 30. Bob, what about the soccer high? Why doesn't it last longer?
Well, I think, yeah, and I agree that this event will be the popularity of this event will increase the further the U.S. women go. If they win the thing and you got a curiosity piece and Megan's coming back home, that's fine. They'll do better. But I think it is that four-year format. We used to get, you know, in the tournament, these games are win or go home. There's so much at stake. You can see the competitiveness of these athletes and the skill that they possess. Those are wonderful things, but you may not be able to see that except every 4 years. And that's, you know, one of the things that they're up against. Americans with the instant gratification, if it didn't happen 5 nanoseconds ago, it's too late for me. And you've got to appreciate, well, it's a little bit like the game, how it's paced and then how these tournaments come every 4 years. So that's why I say it needs a little marketing, because it's a different kind of philosophy that you think about with soccer and its identity.
Why does the soccer, the World Cup, happen once every 4 years? I mean, I realize the Olympics does that, but the Olympics are the Olympics. In every other sport, the World Championships in hockey and basketball, they happen once a year, except in Olympic years. It's an annual event. So I realize they're qualifying during the 3 year interim between World Cups for both men and women. But why is it even set up that way? Is that just part of the goofiness of FIFA?
I mean, sure. Yeah, FIFA's pretty weird, so they kind of do what they want. But I think, you know, soccer is really an international sport. We don't get that kind of here in the U.S. because we're not as into it. But in every other country in the world, pretty much, like, soccer is what people watch. So to make something, a big event out of it, like the Olympics, is kind of, it fits into that, making it a really grand experience. Whereas the Super Bowl is great and all, but it's like when you're world champion, quote unquote, once a year, it's kind of like it loses a little bit of meaning because you get another chance right the next year. It's a little bit more special when there's like, you know, you have to really wait 4 years. One player might only get a chance to play in one World Cup. You're not going to be playing in 8 Super Bowls, maybe. So
one last thing, we're just about out of time, but I wanted to mention the River Hounds, and, you know, they drew a sellout crowd at Highmark Stadium, which is, again, it's not Heinz Field, it's a much smaller stadium, when DC United came in, and it made people say, well, hey, you know, they did well drawing fans for a game against an MLS team. Can Pittsburgh support an MLS team? And I'll start with you, Megan, and then I'll get Bob's response.
A complicated answer. Yes, but not anytime soon. There's definitely support there. Like, we've got the Steel Army, who is really, really, really into watching the River Hounds and all of that. And the team is good. I think they just kind of came out of bankruptcy, so it's a little bit dodgy there. But, I mean, I think they're getting back. You know, the players are good. They're doing well in the league. But they can't fill a 3,500-seat stadium on a regular basis. So how they're expected to fill a 13,000, at least, minimum stadium in MLS every week is kind of, I mean, a little bit too soon, I think. So I think they're on the trajectory. I think it definitely can happen, but I think people kind of saw that DC United game and were like, hey, it's going to happen, like, you know, next 5 years. And I don't think that's really the case. But definitely in the future, I think it's got potential. I think soccer has potential everywhere, actually. But
Bob, your thoughts, quick final thoughts. Can Pittsburgh support an MLS team?
Yeah, you hear about this critical mass every 4 years of popularity and interest in soccer, but they're going to have to grow this sport. It's up against, it's a newcomer on a crowded stage. And, you know, like the Pittsburgh Hornets, a hockey team, was a minor league team for 30-some years before the Penguins appeared. So I think they do have to grow it and get bigger crowds and then have a fan base and get a TV contract, and then everybody will be happy.
Good points, both of you, talking about soccer. And we've been chatting with Megan Ryan, who covers soccer, among other sports, for the Pittsburgh Post-Gazette, and Post-Gazette sports writer emeritus Bob Dvorak. Thank you both for being with us.
Thank you.
You bet, Paul. Thank you.
Coming up, it's the story of the Three Little Pigs Burgers when Essential Pittsburgh continues on 90.5 WESA. It's Essential Pittsburgh. I'm Paul Guggenheimer. The classic children's tale of the Three Little Pigs gets a uniquely Pittsburgh twist, courtesy of our next guest, pop culture contributor Joe Woese. His book, which I happen to be holding in my hand, The Three Little Pigs Burgers, recounts the tale of Lonnie, Donnie, and Ronnie and their efforts to thwart the big bad wolf. He joins us now in studio. Joe Woese, hello, and I hope I gave you the proper intonation on that Pittsburgh
accent. I think it was
pretty
good Pittsburghese. Not too bad.
This is an interesting. This looks beautiful. A beautifully illustrated story of the Three Little Pigs, and I'm looking at some of the text here, which definitely has the Pittsburgh accent incorporated into it. And you did all these illustrations, right?
Yes, did all the illustrations.
Because you're an artist, and they are amazing. This looks like a lot of fun. How did this idea come to you?
Oh, so the idea actually came to me about 10 years ago. I was performing at a storytelling festival down in Florida. And each of the storytellers would get up and do their, you know, round of storytelling. And the first storyteller gets up and says, I'm going to tell a story in English and Russian. And I thought, oh, no, here we go. And the second storyteller, sure enough, says, you know what? That reminds me of a story, which is the worst thing you want to hear at a storytelling festival, surprisingly, because it means we're about to derail. And she said, I'm going to tell you a story in Spanish and English. A third storyteller says, I'm going to tell one in sign language and English. And I get up on stage and I illustrate stories as I tell them live.
And you've done this for the symphony.
I've done that for the symphony and for many other performances. And I go, I don't know a single other language other than English, and I don't know English all that good.
Apparently not.
So I stand up and say on the spot, I'm going to tell you a story in English and Pittsburghese. And then I went into explaining Pittsburghese, and I started telling this version of Three Little Pigs, and it got a lot of laughs, and people were sort of confused by the Pittsburghese, but really seemed to embrace it. And it just sat in the back of my brain for about 10 years.
It was very organic.
It was very organic and of the moment, and then nothing happened. And then on a plane ride back from the Charles M. Schulz Museum, I perform there every year. You know, I've got that five-hour...
Creator of Peanuts.
Yeah, Creator of Peanuts, and one of my heroes. I had this 5 hours of dead time on the plane with nothing to do. And I said, you know what, I'm gonna write out this story. And I wrote the whole story out. And then it took me another year of edits for the story, because every time I would go somewhere in Pittsburgh, I would hear a new word and go, I've got to get that into the book.
And so as you're reading this the first time, what was the reaction that you received from the assembled fans of literature?
The first time I just did a book signing for it, and I did a reading, and a live reading of the book in Pittsburghese, and I was sort of shocked by the amount of laughs it got. As I finished, I thought, well, it's a pretty straightforward retelling of the Three Little Pigs. The only thing I've sort of changed is by adding that new language element and adding some, you know, popular landmarks, popular characters, popular phrases. But it really surprised me the amount of laughs it got. And that's been the response overall, is lots of laughs in it.
What is it about the Pittsburgh accent that you know, we love to make fun of it. It's more of an inside joke. You hear lots of people making fun of it here in Pittsburgh, because I think in the rest of the country, nobody would really understand it. But, you know, you've got Pittsburgh Dad, you have, you know, skits on the radio, on some of the morning shows. And, you have, there was one other famous example of a guy doing a Pittsburgh accent on a national stage.
Oh, it was Seth Meyers.
Seth
too.
Meyers does it. And then on his show, and then Bill Cowher did it in his farewell press conference. Yins know what I'm talking about.
Yeah.
As he finished up. So, you know, what is it about the accent that makes us, is it just that we're so happy to make fun of ourselves, or what?
I think number one, it's sort of remarkably preserved. I think it was the New York Times referenced us as the Galapagos Islands of the English language, which David Conrad, who does a mention in the back of my book, says as well. I think that idea of having something unique, so unique to us, Pittsburgh is a city of great pride, and having something sort of unique, like a language, really sets us apart. And I think it's something that we are very, very proud of, that unique dialect. And I think for so many years, it was something that we tried to hide. We try and lose that dialect. We sort of say, you know, we're a little bit of ashamed of it. And then Pittsburgh, you know, after the 70s went through this moment. After the 70s, the Steelers, you know, there was moments of not doing so well. Our steel mills all shut down, and we became a city of really low self-esteem.
Then Flashdance came along.
And then Flashdance comes along, and then, you know, all these things start to happen, and suddenly Pittsburgh emerges as this very prideful city, with lots of lists to our credits and lots of number one this and number one that, and I think the language is a part of that. It's something we now celebrate, and that's what we do here at Pittsburgh. We celebrate our uniqueness.
We're talking with our culture contributor, Joe Woese, who is a regular on the program, but He's also a real Renaissance man, and so from time to time we talk to him about his various endeavors, the latest of which is the illustrated children's book, The Three Little Pigsburgers, as told in Pittsburghese, and again, written and illustrated by Joe Woes, featuring a Pittsburghese to English dictionary, which we'll get into some of that. But at the risk of putting you on the spot here, I was wondering if you could read an excerpt from this.
Yeah,
for us.
I will. I actually have two favorite excerpts. I have the intro. And by the way, the foreword is written by Rick Seebeck. I should mention that, who did a great job and is sort of a Pittsburgh icon himself.
Read the opening. Really?
Yeah.
You never see that guy anywhere. What are you talking about?
Yeah. So the introduction is, once upon a time, there was these three little Pittsburghers. The mom, Mo, had a big Pittsburgh family. She was just about rid of them all, but the last three, Lonnie, Donnie, and Ronnie, were all still living down in her cellar. It was a real good cellar. It had a bathroom with a shower where they could worship and everything. She even had it done up real nice like a game room so they could watch the game on Sundays. Their old man played for the Steelers. So that's the opening credit. You know, and of course, the Big Bad Wolf doesn't say, "I'll huff and puff, I'll blow your house down."
It's Wolf, isn't it?
It's Big Bad Wolf.
Wolf, okay.
WFF. The Big Bad Wolf says,
WUFF.
Yes, WUFF says, "Then I's going to huff and I's going to puff and I'm going to blow yin's house down." So I think it's a lot of fun. One of my favorite lines.
Not if it's made of bricks and that.
Not if it's made out of steel.
Yes.
Is sort of how they come to resolve it. My favorite line in the book, and I think one of the most Pittsburgh, is when the pigs are gathering the items to build their houses. And I don't use sticks and straw. I use cardboard boxes from Giant Eagle. And then the other one, I'll read this line. The second pig, he weren't no better. He goes downtown, down around back of one of the bars down there on Liberty Avenue, and rummages through the dumpster to get a bunch of aluminum cans and Iron City bottles. He goes and builds his house, a house out of cans and glass bottles. But that line of going downtown, down around, back of one of the bars was a real line I actually heard someone say. I was asking for directions to go, "You can go downtown, down around, down there in Liberty."
Is that where a lot of this comes from? Is your just observing and being a fly on the wall amidst the conversations of Pittsburghers?
It really was, and sort of capturing myself as well. I think like all of us, we say, "Oh, I don't speak Pittsburghese," and then we catch ourselves in a line. Mine, when I caught myself, there's two things that I say. One, and this is a fun one because it's one Mr. Rogers does too, is how we pronounce crayon.
Crown.
But actually, it's a little bit different. If you listen to Mr. Rogers when he goes to visit the Crayola factory, it's the only time he slips up. He says that today we're going to the Crayola factory, boys and girls, and we're going to learn how to make crayons. Here's a blue crayon. Here's a green crayon. Here's a red crayon. And I realized we call it crayons. You know, K-R-A-N-Z. The other one that I slipped up on and had to put into the book, someone asked me to describe the book, and I said, well, it's sort of taking the three little pigs and then adding in the language of Pittsburghese. It's kind of like that. And they went, what? I go, well, it's kind of like that. They go, like that? What's like that? I go, I don't know, but it's got to be in my book. So like that got added to the book.
And we're getting tight on time here, but you've got this dictionary, too, that explains what, as you just did, what certain Pittsburgh words mean.
Yes, I realized as I was writing this book, like, it is impossibly confusing if you don't speak Pittsburghese.
Like if you say, Yin's going downtown, it's are you people going
yes,
to go
absolutely.
Downtown?
Yin's guys going downtown and that. Explaining all those different things and even simple things that we take for granted, like chip chopped ham. What is chip chopped ham? You know, so all those things I needed to really define to put into the book.
It's The Three Little Pittsburghers as told in Pittsburghese. And oh my God, they encountered a big bad wolf. It's written and illustrated by our guest, Joe Woes. Joe, congratulations. You've done it again. Thank you
very much.
And thank you for listening to Essential Pittsburgh on 90.5 WESA. If you missed any portion of the program or want to revisit past segments, you can go to our website at WESA.fm. On Thursday, we will talk exclusively with Governor Wolf on this program, not Governor Wolf. Until tomorrow, I'm Paul Guggenheimer. So long for now.